I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this special bonus edition of Parallax Views, we continue our conversations about COVID-19, the novel coronavirus, this time looking at the effects it will have on globalization with John Pfeffer of Foreign Policy in Focus, who has recently penned two very interesting articles that will form the basis of this episode. The first, and the one that will take up most of our discussion, is Will Coronavirus Kill Globalization? The second, only recently published, is What Coronavirus Says About Us. John's work can be found on such outlets as Common Dreams, Counterpunch, The Nation, and, as previously mentioned, Foreign Policy in Focus. I think you're going to find this to be a fascinating, fascinating conversation. We're talking about the bigger implications of coronavirus in regards to the global economy and globalized politics. Also joining us on this edition of the program is my co-host for Parallax Views, The Week That Was, Casey. Folks, if you haven't checked out Parallax Views, The Week That Was, you can find it on Patreon, patreon.com/parallaxviews. And now, why don't we just cut right to the chase for this bonus episode and get into the conversation with John Pfeffer of Foreign Policy in Focus on the coronavirus and globalization. Welcome to Parallax Views, John Pfeffer of Foreign Policy in Focus. How are you doing today?
Doing good. Thanks for having me on the show.
So I'm also joined here by Casey, my co-host at the Parallax Views Patreon program, The Week That Was, and we're going to be talking about two of John's latest articles. The first one being, Will the Coronavirus Kill Globalization? And the second one being, What the Coronavirus Says About Us. So let's start with the globalization article. It's funny, John, I was talking to you off air about how Pat Buchanan just wrote piece entitled "Will the Coronavirus Kill the New World Order?" And I think he comes from a very different perspective than you do, John.
Well, that's true. I mean, Pat Buchanan, generally speaking, is a, well, I guess he likes to call himself a paleoconservative, very nationalist in perspective, an economic nationalist, similar in some respect to what Steve Bannon has articulated as the ideology he would like Donald Trump to have. And basically, Buchanan would like to see the end of what he calls the New World Order, but which is, in fact, just kind of international liberalism. And I have a different perspective. I mean, I'm critical, of course, of some aspects of globalization, economic globalization. But I'm looking for a more progressive internationalism rather than nationalism as a response.
And what spurred you to think more about the relationship between globalization and coronavirus, or maybe even for my listeners who haven't been thinking about it, what do you think that relationship is between this deadly new virus and globalization?
Well, you know, disease has always accompanied economic globalization, in part because pathogens follow trade routes, and they also follow soldiers as they try to secure trade routes. This has been the case going back thousands of years. You can find that, for instance, two important pandemics were at least partially responsible for bringing down the Roman Empire. There were obviously other factors as well, but these two pandemics certainly weakened Rome and its control, economic control of other countries. You found also that the pandemic, the Spanish flu in 1918, which came on the heels of the end of World War I, was kind of the final nail in the coffin for economic globalization at that time. And that was really the first modern version of economic globalization, what we're more familiar with today. So at that time, of course, you saw an enormous increase in international trade as a percentage of GDP. You saw, steamships bringing containers of goods around the world. You had the telegraph, you had the train. You had all these kind of new technologies that brought the world closer together, all of which was basically sundered by World War I. And then the Spanish flu on top of that was yet another kind of example of how people and goods traveling around the world and bringing the world closer together also was an enormous opportunity for pathogens to reproduce themselves. And that's essentially what all the pathogen is interested in doing, is reproduce itself. So that was kind of the historical background that prompted me to think about what the relationship between the COVID-19 or the current coronavirus and our current version of economic modern globalization.
Casey, I wanted to give you a chance to add anything to what John just said, and maybe if you had any questions.
I'm reminded, and Barbara, what's her last name? The author of The Guns of August, in the prologue of that book, she mentions how in 1910 there was an author that wrote how the increased globalization of the world would lead to an end of all wars as we know it. And of course, 4 years later, that was proven wrong. And The parallel between that and how for the past 10 years we've been told that the intimate economic connections between all the different poles of the world today would facilitate a kind of global neoliberal peace, and how all that's kind of falling apart in the wake of the same kind of tragedy that spelled its doom in 1918. So I definitely see the historical parallels that you're talking about, John. I really don't have any questions at this point. I'm more just listening in, and I'll inject what I can when I can.
Well, you bring up really some important points. The quote from Barbara Tuchman, I think, is illustrative. There was a belief going back to Montesquieu that trade in general would soften the edges between countries, that the capitalism had this kind of softening effect when it came to international trade. Combine that with this notion that was a little bit more recent, you would find it more in the 20th century, that increased contact between people would essentially reduce nationalism, extreme nationalism. And in both cases, we discovered that there was a contrary effect, in fact, that that trade did sometimes have this kind of softening effect, but it also often sharpened conflicts between countries as they came head to head over critical resources, over competition, not just between themselves bilaterally, but competition for markets elsewhere. And that led often to not just kind of trade conflict, but actual outright war. As for people coming in touch, more in touch with one another, it turned out that that too often sharpened conflict, that it wasn't just a matter of people learning more about one another and their cultures. And occasionally that did, of course, lead to greater contact and greater cooperation. But just as often, it led to greater conflict as people began to define themselves more sharply in contrast with one another. So I think that, yeah, those are extremely important points to bring into this in any kind of understanding of the impact of economic globalization.
And this isn't really the first time that globalization has been challenged. You mentioned in your article pandemics like the Hong Kong flu, or even, the specter of Y2K.
That's right. I mean, you know, it's in some ways you could say that economic globalization is quite fragile. And that might seem strange because, of course, if you just your listeners look around the room they're sitting in, they see the evidence of economic globalization right in front of them, whether it's the computer that they're working on that's been assembled in another country with components from a global assembly line, to the food on the table that they eat, much of which is grown in other countries and shipped over great distances. So it would seem at first glance that that's not fragile at all. I mean, we've been the beneficiaries of this global system for decades, and occasionally there are maybe some crimps in the connections, so we might not get our iPhone the day we requested it might come a day later, but generally speaking we're confident that this system is robust. But it's when these threats appear, whether it's Y2K, which was largely an imaginary threat, or a pandemic like our current pandemic, that we realize that it doesn't take much to disrupt this global system. Whether it's in the case of when the coronavirus first hit in China and China started shutting down its manufacturing, suddenly we saw real gaps in delivery of necessary items. And the one I mentioned in my article was just a conversation I had with someone at a dinner party. He was an architect putting up buildings here in the DC area. And he said, I can't get carpets. All the wall-to-wall carpets that we rely on come from China, and suddenly they're just not available. And it's very hard to source from another place because we've already kind of set up to get these carpets, and we can't substitute something else. I mean, we need the carpets, the buildings can't be finished without these carpets. So suddenly you realize that so much depends on every one of the inputs, and if an input is threatened, then frankly the whole system becomes unstable.
And I guess just to maybe back up, because I think the word globalization is thrown around a great deal by both the left and the right. And I think the left and the right have different meanings for that term. I think when the right uses it, it's in a very sort of like vaguely, cryptically anti-Semitic sort of way. What do you people like us mean when we say globalization, especially in terms of, I guess, what could be called the second wave of globalization, and after the collapse of the Soviet bloc?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess first let me comment on kind of the right wing understanding of globalization, because I think you're right. There are various facets to the right wing understanding of this system, one of which is cultural, and that's their notion of cosmopolitanism as being negative, that the mixing of people internationally and this kind of creation of a greater cosmopolitanism, which undermines, say, nationalities and nationalism, that's associated or has historically been associated with Jews and therefore has an anti-Semitic ring to it. Also, on top of that is this notion that the global economic system is controlled by a small elite, and that elite also is Jewish, whether it's the Rothschilds or others. So that too has an anti-Semitic cast to it. The left has similarly criticized globalization, economic globalization, for being an elite project. Generally, there isn't an anti-Semitic connotation to that, but rather a critique of certain institutions, International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, Davos, et cetera. And that these decisions on, say, the rules and regulations of the global economy are done behind closed doors, or not transparent, or certainly not democratic. So that's generally the left's critique of globalization, its political critique. Economic critique, of course, is that it is, say, a industrial strength version of capitalism. In other words, everything that the left, at least the Marxist left, has critiqued about capitalism goes all the more for economic globalization, that it is devoted to extracting as much profit as possible. It accentuates economic inequality. It takes control out of producers, workers, etc., and places it in hands of an economic corporate elite. So there's that critique of economic globalization. But globalization, if we kind of step out of the left-right critique for a moment, globalization is actually a much larger project. It is economic, of course, and it involves greater integration of economic units internationally. And that could be capitalist or it could be non-capitalist. In fact, there are any number of frankly, non-capitalist actors in the global economy that participate in economic globalization. China, nominally communist country, is of course the biggest example, but there are other countries as well that participate that are not what I would call classically capitalist economies. They might be corporatist, they might be communist of some sort or another. There's a political aspect to globalization as well. It's the institutions that have been established to monitor and regulate the global economy, as well as kind of global interactions more generally. And you could argue that the UN, for instance, is a primary example of political globalization. And it's dealing with many things that have nothing to do with the economy or only have glancing connections to the economy, such as, health questions or questions of child soldiers. So these are treaties, et cetera, that represent kind of the culmination of political globalization, of nation states that have essentially ceded a certain amount of responsibility to international authorities. And then finally, a cultural/social aspect to globalization, in which, frankly, we're talking about, for instance, people moving around, ideas moving around, and culture moving around, so that instead of having relatively isolated national communities in which people stay put for their entire lifetimes and the culture that's consumed is produced within that community, you have much greater circulation of people, ideas, and so forth.
And I guess with the fall of the Soviet Union, we have sort of this globalization, you know, accelerating through the past few decades. And I think a lot of it, as you note in the article, is really tied to modern medicine. Why has modern medicine been so important to the project of globalization?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would start first by saying that, you know, that the pathogens that we're dealing with, in some sense, come from the dawn of our economic activity as humans. When we were hunters and gatherers, we were pretty much dispersed. We had diseases, of course, but those diseases did not spread in any significant sense because we were relatively isolated. As soon as we started developing agriculture and the urban communities that could be supported by agriculture, that's when we started to develop the kinds of diseases that have spread in a modern sense and have jumped from animals to humans, in part because we were raising livestock and that livestock lived in close proximity to us and therefore gave those pathogens, say, new opportunities to reproduce, not just in animals, but in us as well. So pathogens have been kind of, these pathogens have been intricately connected to our economic activity. Once we kind of went global in our economic activities, well, suddenly we, you know, gave these pathogens even more opportunities. I mean, this is like the Olympics for pathogens, you know, a great opportunity to kind of get together with folks from around the world and spread rapidly. The ability to control those pathogens has made modern globalization possible. In other words, if we did not have modern medicine that could control the spread of pathogens, if we didn't come up with antiviral and antibacterial weapons to control these pathogens, well, economic globalization would simply not be possible. It would have fallen apart because of the spread of disease, as we saw in part in 1918 with the Spanish flu, and we just would not have been able to rebuild the global economy after that point. So our current pandemic will, of course, also eventually be dealt with by modern medicine. And, you know, there are any number of stories about the various efforts underway to develop some kind of vaccine or to use existing, for instance, anti-malarial medicine to stop the spread of this disease. Eventually, modern medicine will get this one under control as well, with the expected resumption of economic globalization, the expected resumption of trade, of travel, and the like. The question really is whether this current outbreak will prompt a reconceptualization of economic globalization, not by itself. I mean, the pandemic, our current pandemic by itself, will not cause this reconsideration. It's really in conjunction with other trends that are going on right now. For instance, there are political trends, such as a rise of a new right and a kind of new sovereignist nationalism that has attacked economic globalization. But there are also kind of material changes, such as changes in how we manufacture things, automation, for instance. If automation becomes as widespread as many analysts expect, there's really no reason to have a global assembly line. If you can produce everything with a 3D printer in the next room, why would you possibly want to outsource that to another country and incur additional transportation costs? So if we see, for instance, the resourcing, which is the opposite of outsourcing, the resourcing, the bringing back of production closer to home, we will see a profound transformation of the globalization project.
And before we move on to your latest article, maybe we could talk a little bit about what all of this spells out for both China and the U.S., because that's a large part of your article on coronavirus and globalization is about how China is going to be very pivotal in all of this.
Absolutely. I mean, prior to the current outbreak, we had kind of two contrasting approaches to how the United States and China should work together. One was that we would achieve some kind of consensus, not on everything, but on key elements of the global economy and issues such as climate change, and that the two countries would kind of work more or less hand in hand in if not transforming the international community, at least moving it in a somewhat different direction. And that was more or less the approach of the Obama administration. Since then, however, there's been an entirely different approach coming from not just the Trump administration, but I would say the kind of consensus view within the China Watcher community here in the United States.
Can I comment real quickly on that?
Please do.
I was going to say, I think there's been a lot of changes, even for like the sort of democratic or maybe technocratic centrists in this country with regards to foreign policy in general. I remember under the Obama administration, we were having the Russian reset, and I feel like that's really gone by the wayside. A lot has changed in the course of, 10 years.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, you saw the changes take place during the Obama administration. And there was a recognition, for instance, of the rise of the rest, of a kind of a shifting of power away from American unilateralism towards other centers of power. You saw, for instance, China developing essentially an alternative global economic system.
Is that the BRICS nations or?
Well, first, of course, with BRICS, that precedes the Obama administration by some amount of time. But then BRICS kind of falls apart, in part because China really is moving much more quickly forward, and is not necessarily coordinating with India or with Russia. I mean, there is some coordination, but on the economic side, China is really pushing ahead with its own Belt and Road Initiative. In other words, it's kind of abandoning this notion that China can create with other powerful countries of the global south, along with Russia, a multipolar economic system, and instead kind of saying, look, we're going to go it our own way. We have enough money, enough capital to do so. We have our own kind of economic vision, and we're going to create a kind of hub and spoke system that with Beijing at the center of both manufacturing and of finance, creating our own alternative IMF, essentially, our own alternative World Bank, to lend money to our allies to kind of buy into our new manufacturing and service and financial system. So China is basically going on its own, and accompanying that, especially with Xi Jinping, is a new kind of nationalism as well. And there's considerable conflict between the United States and China over this. And it comes out, of course, over, some longstanding issues, currency questions, international property rights, but at South China Sea, some military conflict there. But it comes to a head really just as Trump is coming into office. And as a result, we have an entirely different kind of approach towards U.S.-China relations and how the United States and China might work or not work together in nudging the international community in a particular direction. Trump administration not interested in that at all, not interested, in fact, in any kind of, say, reform of the international community, at least as the Obama administration understood it. What this means in terms of economic globalization and dealing with, say, the what happens when we get this current coronavirus under control, is that increasingly, I think, unless we have a different president here who really undertakes a fundamentally different approach to China, we're going to have a continual divergence of approach. And that will make it extremely difficult for the international community as a whole to both kind of reform economic globalization, but also the political institutions that are necessary to get a handle on these global problems, such as global warming, but pandemics as well. Now, that, I hope, will, you know, that divergence will last only a short period of time. In other words, I do think that for a variety of reasons, China and the United States will see kind of convergent interests once again, and despite disagreements about a variety of different matters, will decide ultimately that they do have to work together and get other countries on board to not only come up with the rules and regulations for a new kind of global economy, but to implement those as well.
It's interesting. I've been thinking lately about, I'm sure you're familiar with John Mersheimer, and most people know him, of course, for his book on AIPAC that he co-wrote with Stephen Walt, but I always found his book on the tragedy of great power politics equally fascinating. And of course, Mersheimer comes from a much more conservative perspective, but his sort of idea is that we really can't break free of this war between different nations globally trying to achieve sort of the hegemon status, or the status of the hyperpower. Although at the beginning of that book, he says, well, there could be some type of crisis that would change that. I'm curious as to whether you think this crisis may be the catalyst for that kind of change.
Yes, I think that is an important kind of externality, if you will. In other words, the system as Mersheimer presents it does necessarily lead to the kind of conflicts that, for instance, around a rising power like China and what is often called the Thucydides dilemma. In other words, when an established power deals with a rising power, as Athens and Sparta dealt with during the Peloponnesian War, this dynamic between the United States as an established power and China as a rising power will necessarily lead to conflict, and not just kind of bilateral conflict, but potentially much more widespread conflict. There are other things that could, external to this particular system, could prompt a transformation of this dynamic. And any kind of external threat can serve as that externality. In other words, it could have been climate change. And I think to a certain extent during the Obama administration, climate change did serve as this threat that both the United States and China perceived as integral to their national interest and worth sitting down at the table and hammering out, along with a lot of other nations, an accord in Paris to deal with. This pandemic is potentially another one. It's, of course, has more short-term effects, death in the short term, economic recession in the short term. So unlike climate change, which, except for the people of the Maldive Islands and, you know, outlying areas of Bangladesh and maybe, you know, parts of Miami, et cetera, was not perceived as an immediate threat by people, and not perceived as an immediate threat to the global economy, at least judging by the rise of the stock market over the last 3 years. The coronavirus, on the other hand, has had, you know, immediate impact. So, yes, I think that it is possible given different leadership, obviously our current president, as long as he's calling the coronavirus the China virus, that makes it a little bit more difficult for the United States and China to sit down and you know, deal with this problem bilaterally and also forge a kind of new international consensus. But I would also add one more thing, and that is after the SARS epidemic, we did, of course, the world, the international community did come up with new rules and regulations for dealing with pandemics, and they were quite good on paper. It's just that countries ignored them when push came to shove, when the next pandemic came down the pike. So it's not just a question of coming up with the rules and regulations, it's actually coming up with enforcement mechanisms. And that's the hardest thing, because enforcement mechanism means that you're ceding more sovereignty to an international authority. And that's something that, of course, the Pat Buchanans and the Donald Trumps of the world are absolutely against. But often the Xi Jinpings of the world are not that happy about either. So the question is how severe the crisis will be to prompt countries that, like the United States, like China, have their exceptionalist traditions, will be willing to put those on the back burner in order to cede authority to international institutions that will be necessary to handle crises of this nature.
Do you think China can come out of this? I don't know. As you put it, could China still come out of this as a winner? I mean, China is so known for being the world's leading manufacturer. I think that's going to change very rapidly.
Well, you know, so far at least, China has been the country that has most dramatically and effectively dealt with the pandemic within its borders. So it has already, within the last week, ended local transmission of the disease. So any additional outbreaks have been attributed entirely to people coming from outside the country. So that's quite a remarkable achievement. It also enables China to basically put its manufacturing back online more quickly than other countries. Now, of course, China was already moving in a direction towards greater value added in its production. So, and it has the foreign capital, I mean, the capital that it has from its trade balances, to invest in upgrades in its manufacturing. So I would say at this point that China has a pretty good chance of coming out of this in better shape than a number of other countries. And then if you add on to that, China's kind of taken the position that the U.S. usually takes in this kind of situation, as being kind of the altruist of first response. In other words, when there have been earthquakes or tsunamis in the past, the United States has been, you know, right there offering assistance, often the U.S. military helping as well. But with this, because China's, you know, been the first to kind of recover, it has been the one sending experts to Italy, for instance. It's been the one who has been sending face masks and other kind of health supplies to affected countries. So so China, I think, is going to get a lot of goodwill a lot of political capital from its response to the global pandemic as well.
And I was just going to say, I'd be remiss to deny that for the past 3 years, China has also been outsourcing a lot of its manufacturing to various African countries. And since we don't know the spread of coronavirus in most of sub-Saharan Africa, that may prove to be a variable on some level. Like the trend going on has been that China is moving towards a more digitized economy, bit by bit, admittedly, but manufacturing is already moving away from them. And as such, this is, I would suppose, hastening that process.
Yes, and I think perhaps the greater vulnerability for China is not so much the manufacturing that it's outsourced, but its reliance on raw materials from Africa, from Southeast Asia, even, you know, well, food, of course, soybeans from Brazil and other countries in Latin America. So the question for China is whether, you know, it can escape a serious global downturn if that means that its access to the raw materials it requires for manufacturing is compromised. We might see a similar resourcing phenomenon for China as well, as it decides ultimately that previously it made economic sense to outfactoring to cheaper labor areas, but because of greater automation and because of political turmoil and the fragility of the global economy, it makes more sense for it to resource that manufacturing back to China itself. Certainly, China is in a position to do that in a way that some other countries are not, in part because the manufacturing wasn't outsourced all that long ago, so the workers are still have those skills. Plus, it has, you know, pretty large surplus labor force, which it can either draw from the existing manufacturing sector or from the rural economy. So I think in general, you know, there are some vulnerabilities for China, but it's in a pretty good position. I mean, I should also, you know, I should put an asterisk to that, saying there are other vulnerabilities to Chinese economy in addition to its reliance on raw materials overseas. I mean, it is, there's a huge amount of debt that's in the Chinese economy. It has, you know, basically a real estate bubble. Its banks are in many cases in very challenging position. So there are a lot of reasons why, you know, the Chinese economy, you know, is problematic. But those are in some sense separate from the current pandemic problem.
Now, you note in the article that the new status quo of a revived Cold War between the two hegemons, you know, Beijing and Washington, is unworkable. Do you think that people in Washington recognize this? And also, do you think if Trump is out of office by next year, do you think the folks in Washington that are against Trump will approach these things differently? What's the difference in policy with regards to people in Washington?
Well, I'm sorry to say that the folks here in Washington have basically adopted a confrontational approach towards China.
Regardless of Republican or Democrat.
Correct. And that includes a lot of people who had, you know, previously worked for Democratic administrations, and even people who previously considered themselves quite supportive of engagement with China. In other words, there is a perception that China has become uncompromising, ultra-nationalist, that it needed someone like Trump to say no and impose tariffs or push back on intellectual property rights to signal a new position or a new stance on military issues across the board. Now, that's not everybody, but unfortunately, I did a long piece in The Nation kind of outlining this new consensus position among China watchers across the political spectrum. There are, however, I think a lot of people who, they wouldn't call themselves China watchers. I mean, they're just involved in U.S.-China relations at one level or another in a pragmatic sense. So they've been working with China on economic issues, on environmental issues, on science. And there are a number of initiatives that are still ongoing that involve cooperation between the United States and China. For instance, on energy questions, on sustainable energy and the search for workable solutions that are cost effective, that both countries can take advantage of, and that straddle public and private realm. That cooperation, which began during the Obama administration, is still continuing, though quietly, during the Trump years. If Trump loses in November, I don't expect that elite opinion will change much, but I do expect that those kinds of quiet programs of cooperation among specialists, essentially, will continue and could serve as the basis for some, say, future more explicit cooperation between the two governments.
And you note that we do need some type of U.S.-China cooperation. You also say, if I can just pull a quote here, it's time for another wave of globalization, but this time one that reduces carbon emissions, proceeds more equitably, and strengthens the capacity of international institutions to fight pandemics. I'm curious, and I know this is a very speculative question, but what would that new wave of globalization look like? Because you're alluding to it there. I don't know if you have any thoughts on policies or maybe how we could head more in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, first I'd say, you know, it's quite remarkable what has happened just in the last several weeks in terms of a transformation of the global economy. And I'm not talking just about the recession, which is, you know, it's something that is volatile in its own right. But I'm talking about, the reduction of air travel, the reduction of container traffic, the reduction of things that basically produce carbon emissions. And although, you know, that may not mean very much if economic activity ramps up as soon as the coronavirus fades, which is what we saw after the last financial crisis, it does speak to the ability of economic actors and governments to, if necessary, reduce and dramatically reduce carbon emissions. When I talk about a new form of economic globalization, what I'm talking about is not doing what we did after the last financial crisis. In other words, recognizing that this was an extraordinary opportunity, not one that anyone would want to repeat, but an extraordinary opportunity to restructure our economy along sustainable lines. That means, okay, we're the airline industry is begging for subsidies. The cruise industry, the ports, sure, governments should step in and help these institutions, but they have to do so with strings attached. And those strings have to be connected to a reduction of those that carbon footprint. This could be done nation by nation. But if we're talking about an effective global response, this should be coordinated at a global level. We had the introduction in a couple of different countries of Green New Deals, and those are, I would say, largely abstract. I mean, they have had some policy or some legislation connected to them, but in the absence of a real strong support at the top here in the United States or in England, they're just not going to get going. But coming out of this coronavirus, one could imagine government saying, okay, look, you know, this we have to do something that is connected to both reducing our carbon footprint and ensuring that our societies are safe from infection. And let's do these two things together. In other words, making our global community sustainable and secure. Restructuring the global economy along those lines, prior to, you know, say, 3 months ago, people would have scoffed and said, that's impossible. There's no way that we could do that. But I think now that we've seen what has happened in the last couple of weeks, it's just really a question of the political will. It's not really a question of whether we can do it. We've demonstrated that we can do it. And that's really the political opportunity that's on the table right now.
you have this article, What the Coronavirus Says About Us, and you look at four different countries, China, South Korea, Italy, and the United States. I know we can't get too deep into it, but maybe some of the basic bullet points about how these countries have dealt with it, pro and con, if you could briefly, most important points.
Sure. Let's start at the top, which would be South Korea, which I think has been the most successful country in dealing with this problem. And the bullet points would be South Korea is an extraordinarily well-developed technologically country. A country that's well-developed technologically. It was able to get its test kits up and running very quickly. The government was very efficient in ensuring that people would be tested widely. There were more people tested every day in South Korea than were tested overall in the United States over the course of the outbreak. You had a kind of pretty widespread spirit of compliance as well. They didn't lock down urban areas, country as China did when China responded to initially to the outbreak in Wuhan, but through targeted intervention and sophisticated technology, including tracking people through GPS to ensure that they upheld their individual quarantines, South Korea was able to really effectively deal with this crisis. And there are lessons there, I think, for all countries to learn. China was more of a blunt force approach. I mean, they locked down Hubei province, canceled all transportation, enforced very stringently the individual quarantines within that area, and also managed to do so in a very ham-fisted way, that's been effective. In other words, China, as I mentioned before, has brought the epidemic under control, but there have been significant side effects that have been negative. There have been people who have died as a result of the quarantine, not because they died of the coronavirus, but because their caregivers were separated from them and they couldn't live without their caregivers, or because they didn't have access to other medical technologies that were necessary. Italy has been, the hardest hit out of China, and the rate of infection has increased dramatically there. And initially, the country responded in a kind of xenophobic way by blaming the problem on outsiders. But it was really the failure of the hospital system to react in a effective and urgent way that enabled the virus to spread very quickly in Italy, as well as a general spirit of non-compliance. If Korea, South Korea, represents the best of compliance, of people basically following orders for the good of the community as a whole, Italians were doing the opposite. They were thinking about themselves and not the community as a whole, as they tried to figure out ways of getting around various travel bans and thus spreading the virus more resolutely around the country.
Now, there's been talk, really briefly, there's been talk that, this is the fault of Italy's single-payer system in healthcare.
Yeah, well, I'm not really qualified to comment on that. I mean, from what I understand, they have a very good healthcare system in terms of its coverage. How individual hospitals respond on any given basis, I think, is more a question of those hospitals and whether they are well-resourced and well-run, and has little to do with how the insurance is actually handled within the country. But again, I'm not really a specialist on Italian healthcare, so I'm reluctant to say more than that. But finally, in the last couple of minutes, just about the United States. In my article, I talk about kind of the five stages of American exceptionalism. And this is, how we responded, exemplified by our commander-in-chief. And that is that first stage, it wasn't going to happen to us. Second stage was it might happen to us, but it's the fault of foreigners. The third stage is that it might happen to us, but, we don't really have to worry about it. because it's not going to affect us in the same way that it affects other countries. Fourth stage is it might affect us the way it's affecting other countries, but we don't have to have a kind of unified federal approach to it. We can have a kind of haphazard state-by-state approach. And then the final fifth stage is, we've really screwed up. And, you know, the president's, you know, has exemplified this approach by first denying that this was going to be a problem, making sure that we were basically unprepared at all levels for dealing with this, not having any of the technology in place, the test kits, the masks, the ventilators, and then ultimately saying, hey, it's basically up to you guys. He was talking about the states themselves to deal with this. You don't look to us, the federal government, for help in this regard. And this, I think, has exposed the United States to the potential for a spread that's could be catastrophic. A lot of it depends, of course, on you know the impact of state by state regulations on remain in place. But that we won't find out for another couple of weeks.
Well, John Pfeffer of Foreign Policy in Focus, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. Any parting words about this pandemic? And maybe we can just sum it up with the title of your headline. What does coronavirus say about us? What does it tell us about ourselves?
Well, here in the United States, and you know, I was of course talking about what it means in a variety of different cultural contexts. But here in the United States, I think, you know, in the same way that I talked about the necessity of rethinking economic globalization, I think we have to rethink, you know, what it means to be the United States. If we are truly united as states, then we have to come up with national health care. We have to have a much better coordinated response at a federal level to problems of this nature, both chronic and acute. If we don't, then, well, I'm afraid that the scenario I spell out in the novel I wrote, Splinterlands, will come to pass, and that is the fragmentation of this country.
Well, again, thank you, John Pfeffer, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners check out your work and also the Splinterlands trilogy, the books you just mentioned?
Well, they can go to the Foreign Policy and Focus website, which is fpif.org. They can go to my website, which is just johnpfeffer.com. They can go to any online booksellers, or even better yet, their neighborhood bookstore to find my books.
Thank you again, John Pfeffer.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, that does it for this special bonus edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed, or at least found very informative, our conversation with John Pfeffer. Please be sure to check out his work, the Splinterlands Trilogy. Very good reading. And also his articles at Foreign Policy in Focus, Counterpunch, Common Dreams, and other outlets. In addition, thanks to my co-host for the Parallax Views of the Week That Was program, the great Casey, for helping me co-host this edition of the show. If you like what you hear, please check out Parallax Views of the Week That Was. We're going to be releasing a sort of addendum to this episode for Parallax Views Patreon subscribers very shortly. So there you have it. Another reason to donate to the Parallax Views Patreon, where you can also hear archived editions of past Parallax Views programs. As always, you can drop me a line on Twitter or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. If you'd like to share your thoughts with me about this edition of the program. And with that being said, until next time, You've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.